The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start with the headline on the front page for the cover story. Are we becoming a low-cost hub? Discount airlines are beefing up their capacities at RDU, but the big three, American, Delta, and United, are not ready to give in just yet. And that's the headline on the front page. The article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Budget Carriers Change RDU. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onisorge. At Raleigh-Durham International Airport, bright yellow construction vehicles on the tarmac hint at the $2.5 billion in investments that are coming as officials prioritize recruiting new air service. RDU is pushing for more carriers and more destinations, goals that airport officials say will bring opportunities that are worth the investment. Already, the airport's efforts have meant new flights to places such as Austin, Texas, and New Orleans, but there's a clear pattern developing that may make the second busiest airport in North Carolina a destination city for low-cost and ultra-low-cost carriers. About 60% of RDU's 57 destinations are now served by budget carriers such as Southwest, JetBlue, Allegiant, and Frontier Airlines, as legacy carriers such as Delta, American, and United focus on serving RDU passengers to their hubs for connections with more frequency. For economic developers such as Chris Chung, who heads the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, the carrier flag may not be as important as having nonstop flight access to various cities. Certain companies want to locate near airports that connect to as many markets as possible, he says. Businesses want more choices. So 57 destinations is better than 56, and sometimes that's regardless of what some of those markets even are. With the emergence of budget and ultra-low-cost carriers at RDU, one would think ticket prices would go down for business and leisure travelers. But that's where the picture gets cloudy. In 1997, boarding a plane for a business meeting in Atlanta used to set you back an average of $160 for a one-way ticket. If you take the same trip today, it averages about $140, according to the Bureau of Transportation Statistics. But those numbers are somewhat deceptive. The current cost does not include the $25 to $35 baggage check fees, an expense that even a decade ago was typically complimentary. Amid that backdrop, the real price passengers pay to fly is rising, and even the addition of more budget flights can't stop their takeoff. Added fees and the potential for rising fuel costs on the horizon threaten to further derail the fare progress, even as ultra-low-cost carriers zero in on RDU, already the cheapest among North Carolina's three major airports. While low-cost carriers Frontier and Allegiant have been ramping up in recent years, notably sinking some base ticket prices in the process, they come with their own hidden frills fees, sometimes making up the difference by charging for carry-ons and seat selection. And fuel costs, the great equalizer for budget and mainstream carriers alike, are on the rise, meaning business travelers, regardless of where they're flying, could face some pain ahead. Serving new cities. In a single morning at RDU in February, Denver budget carrier Frontier added six new routes to its Triangle lineup, including services RDU has coveted for years, such as San Juan, Puerto Rico, and San Antonio. Over the next 2 months, it would add five more to its RDU repertoire, a list that now includes 20 flights. Allegiant, a leisure-focused carrier out of Las Vegas, would add its own new offerings to the mix when it announced a nonstop flight to Destin, Fort Walton in Florida, the latest in a network that includes destinations such as Cincinnati, New Orleans, and the Florida locations of Orlando and Punta Gorda. The expansion of those airlines, both classified as ultra-low-cost carriers, or ULCCs, means that of RDU's routes, 40% are served by no-frills carriers. But in terms of total flights from RDU, the legacy players still control capacity, and as they tend to offer more frequencies. American, for example, is heavy on Dallas-Fort Worth and the New York area, while Delta is also big on New York and on Atlanta from RDU. The mix of carriers and strategy often pushes RDU's average fares down when compared to cities such as Charlotte, where American controls about 90% of the flights, thereby offering little or no competition. Cheap tickets, more choices. But what was surprising to find in the Triangle Business Journal analysis of average fares from RDU in the past 30 years is the minimal change in average fares despite the shift to budget carriers. Overall, average prices from RDU are down just $19 since 1990, and in many cases, fares are actually up. Flights to the Washington, D.C. Metro, for example, averaged $152 in 2008. Last year, they averaged $162. And that's not counting the baggage fees and price bump for aisle seats and various other extras. While legacy airlines have long seen RDU competition from lower-cost carriers such as Southwest and JetBlue, the emergence of the ULCC category is a new phenomenon. Allegiant kicked off its first flights out of RDU in May 2015, initially serving a handful of Florida destinations such as Orlando and St. Pete Clearwater. While Frontier has been at RDU since 2010, when Midwest Airlines shifted to the Frontier brand, it transitioned into a low-cost model in 2013 when it was acquired by private equity firm Indigo Partners. Until recently, the bulk of ULCC-served flights were to strict leisure markets, such as Allegiant's Florida offerings. Frontier had been adding in a slew of mid-tier cities from Milwaukee to New Orleans to Detroit. And it's all making a difference, both in base fare price and perception. RDU officials and economic recruiters say the uptick in flights and carriers boosts the region's brand, bringing in prestige and connectivity that translates to real opportunities for the state. Amazon, for example, toured the airport as part of its site visit for its 50,000 job HQ2 and has pointed to air connectivity as a crucial factor in considering sites across the nation. William Swellbar, a consultant with Delta Airport Consultants, says an airport's hub status used to be critical to economic development, but that's no longer necessarily the case. The diversity of service that a Raleigh-Durham has, being able to offer a menu of service offerings, is as much of a benefit as having a hub today, he says. Chung agrees, saying that while hubs such as Charlotte Douglas International Airport are still big drivers for major companies in the state, so is the wide connectivity offered by RDU. At the same time, the additional gates and upkeep required of such a busy airport is costly. ULCCs, like all growing carriers at RDU, bring in additional operational costs. And they serve far less passengers than traditional carriers, meaning less revenue for RDU in return. Managing growth. In its most recent budget, annual operating expenses at RDU added up to $75.7 million. And that's as of today. RDU is planning more than $2.5 billion in airport investments over the next few years. Airports, RDU included, pay for projects in three ways, through grants, fees, such as those for parking and landing, and what's called a passenger facility charge that's a small part of your ticket price. RDU Airport Authority CEO Mike Landguth had long campaigned for the ability to raise the PFC to $8.50. Currently, it's capped by the federal government at $4.50, and recent lobbying attempts by the industry to raise the cap have not been successful. RDU's current sum is spoken for, allocated through 2032, to pay off Terminal 1 improvements. RDU has secured funds from the state, recently getting $52 million from state taxpayers for its planned 11,500-foot runway, but plans for the coming years will be costlier than ever. Officials have said that to accomplish everything from new gate additions to a new consolidated rental car facility, fees could go up in the coming years, and fees can trickle down to fare prices. Legacy carriers remain confident. Executives at Legacy Airlines, the bulk of RDU's business, insist they don't feel threatened by the lower-cost airlines. For example, United has even decreased the capacity of its economy tier in recent months. On an earnings call, United's chief commercial officer, Andrew Nocella, rejected a theory that United's move was a response to ULCCs. "Our inventory for basic economy is not a strategic decision," he said. "It really is driven by the yield management system, trying to maximize the expected value of each seat. And so, to the extent demand is stronger, the yield management system will make your basic economy fares available because they are the lowest fares. And when demand is weaker, it will have more there is nothing strategic about it. He said, at Delta, President Glenn Hotenstein said on a recent earnings call that when the airline gets to the right operating gauge, we can compete in almost every sector, whether or not it's against a ULCC. He added, generally, where we tend to lose money is where we can't get to scale. So the smaller equipment type in almost every class is the least profitable. That's why Delta, RDU's largest airline in terms of passengers, upgraded its nonstops to both Paris and Austin, Texas in recent months. Swellbar predicts that as the trend grows, legacy players will fight back with no-frills services of their own. But whether it's a budget carrier or a legacy airline, the big variable threatening to raise prices is the rising cost of fuel. Fares are too low for oil prices this high, Doug Parker, CEO of American, said on an earnings call in January, predicting prices will soon adjust. Recent reports from the major airlines show those fares are getting higher. In April, Parker told analysts earnings were down year over year, driven by an increase in fuel year over year. Fuel prices have increased yet again just in the last, since we closed the quarter, he said. The increase amounted to $441 million just in the first quarter for the carrier, which is now predicting a 30% increase in consolidated fuel expense for 2018. Southwest Chief Financial Officer Tammy Romo said on an April earnings call that its first quarter economic fuel price per gallon of $2.09 would rise to $2.20 in the firm's second quarter. Right now, Southwest maintains that it's well-positioned to manage our way through a real fuel price shock, CEO Gary Kelly told analysts. If we get to $100 plus a barrel, then I think we have something else to talk about, he said. I think we all need to recognize that margins will be impacted somewhat when fuel prices go up. So if fuel escalates more rapidly, clearly that would put more pressure on us to have our revenues cover that. That won't happen in a quarter. But it could definitely translate to a ticket price, even at a ULCC. If fuel is to go up X amount, you're going to recapture Y percentage. And the industry will see that in general, not just us. Lucas Johnson, Senior Vice President of Commercial at Allegiant, said on an April earnings call. Impact of low-cost carriers. The emergence of Frontier and Allegiant and RDU haven't just impacted cost, they've also added flights to the network that legacies alone would have been unlikely to deliver, confirms Mike Walden, economist and NC State University professor. He points to the nimbleness of the low-cost model in allowing the carriers to take more risks with their route selections. Of the 23 routes served by Frontier and Allegiant, nearly 50% face no competition from legacy players. While the low-cost carriers, just like the legacy airlines, are attracted to the triangle by the market's demographics, their RDU offerings are evidence that they often evaluate a route's convenience to their fleet, not just passenger demand. Many of the routes, including new Frontier additions such as Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Portland, Maine, and Syracuse, New York, don't put up the kind of numbers Delta and American typically require in order to start a new service, admits Frontier's Josh Fleer, Director of Planning and Services at Frontier. When Delta debuted its Paris flight, for example, it did so after compiling years' worth of numbers to justify the dollars they'd spend on the service. United's nonstop to San Francisco came after years of costly studies by RDU. Frontier, however, purports to create its own demand through low-cost options, and it has worked before. When Frontier added Trenton, New Jersey to its RDU lineup in 2013, practically zero passengers were traveling between the two cities each day, according to RDU. Frontier had this cool idea that Trenton was going to be the next big thing, and I'm telling you right now, they were the only ones that thought that. RDU spokeswoman Christy Van Auken says, fast forward to today and spread out across four weekly Frontier flights to Trenton, the route averages 90 passengers per day each way. Incentives matter. Incentives offered by the airport under a previous air service recruitment policy, such as landing fee abatement and marketing support, further justified the bet. Frontier can make the additions by reorganizing its schedule, not by pushing additional planes, making it a low-hassle gamble for the airline. And with smaller markets, it's making bets legacy players would likely ignore, such as an RDU nonstop to Harrisburg, a route that right now averages just 8 passengers per day each way, according to RDU. But the nimbleness of its model works in reverse, too. Allegiant, for example, was quick to cancel initial plans to debut a Puerto Rico flight last year, just months after making the announcement. When hurricanes stifled demand, it reallocated its resources to test out other routes, and Frontier, which classifies the bulk of its service as seasonal, suspended services to Cleveland, Chicago, and Atlanta in 2016. As ULCCs often tuck RDU routes into their schedule at the convenience of the fleet, flights can be limited to certain days and times, which works for the flexible leisure traveler. Frontier's nonstop flight to Las Vegas, for example, may just set you back $197, sans bags, round trip, but you'll be arriving back at RDU at 4:30 a.m., perhaps too exhausted for your morning meeting. More low-cost carriers could be coming. The airport has confirmed past discussions with the nation's eighth-largest commercial carrier, Spirit Airlines. Of the big three domestic budget carriers, Frontier, Allegiant, and Spirit, it's the only one without a presence in North Carolina. In recent years, it has been building out its network aggressively, first in top 30 markets. RDU has drafted a new incentives policy aimed at luring new services and even new carriers to the airport. The policy puts new carriers in line for landing fee abatement and $100,000 in marketing and promotion assistance. In recent years, RDU has been building out its network aggressively, first in top 30 markets. Delta Airport Consulting's Swellbar says it's only a matter of time before that network expands to RDU, based on the area's demographics. At an Airport Authority meeting April 19, Van Auken told the board the policy to be voted on in May could specifically attract new ULLCs. Swellbar says the Triangle's demographics will continue to recruit budget and traditional airlines alike. Raleigh is probably one of the most exciting marketplaces in the U.S. today, he says. Where there's growth, there's going to be new air service. Where there's new air service, there's good competition. They compete on price, and we know that price is the primary driver for consumers to make a choice in air travel. And there's a short article accompanying this article headlined, Budget Carriers Face Scrutiny After Incidents. Even as budget carriers grow at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, they faced a slew of particularly public scrutiny over the past month. Reliability challenges with the Allegiant Airlines fleet was the subject of an extensive 60 Minutes story, which said the airline had an alarming number of aborted takeoffs and persistent problems. Allegiant President John Redmond called the report misleading and inaccurate in a recent earnings call after the program aired. We had our reliability challenges in 2015 and 2016, but that's old news, he said, noting that after the piece, the carrier had experienced cancellations and a reduction in bookings. The degree of those have reduced each day to a point we are starting to reach normalcy, he said. An RDU spokesman said no mechanical issues of note had been recorded regarding Allegiant in the Triangle. At Southwest Airlines, a mechanical issue led to tragedy when debris from an engine smashed a window and a passenger was killed. It was a dark day, but the compassion and concern and support since the event have been truly extraordinary, and it just touches your soul, CEO Gary Kelly told analysts on an earnings call. More recently, Southwest experienced a window crack on another flight that had to make an unplanned landing. Challenges could loom ahead for Frontier, too, as its pilots have asked to be released from an 18-month-old remediation. They say they are the lowest-paid pilots of narrow-body jets in the U.S., with pay rates for captains coming in at 40% below the industry average. And now we'll turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal, as the editor's notebook refers to this article. The headline, Nonstop Flights Reflect Area's Growing Clout. And this is written by Sugata Mukherjee, the editor of the Triangle Business Journal. Our centerpiece this week is a fascinating story on the changing landscape of Raleigh-Durham International Airport. What we are noticing is the budget carriers such as Southwest, JetBlue, Allegiant, and Frontier are filling the void left by American, Delta, and United. In the past 6 months, budget carriers have announced nonstop service to almost 20 cities across the country. While some of them overlap services offered by the legacy carriers, many of them are new. Now, among the 57 cities you can fly direct from RDU, the budget carriers control almost 60% of those routes. American, Delta, and United still lead with total seats because they fly to their hub airports from RDU several times per day. Air carriers are changing, and fast. One would think that if the budget carriers have a larger presence at an airport, the average ticket prices would plummet. But they never really did, if one looks at the statistics from the U.S. Department of Transportation. For local flyers, that certainly is disappointing. But one has to put things in perspective. Average fares out of Charlotte Douglas International Airport are way higher than RDU because American controls 90% of the flights, so essentially there is little competition. And because there is little competition, American can offer more direct service to other cities and maintain its juicy yields. Let's not forget the merger of American and U.S. Airways created this monopolistic atmosphere in the Queen City, although U.S. Airways had a stronghold for years as Charlotte was one of its hub operations. For RDU, having more carriers offering nonstop service to new cities is a good thing. It shows the area's clout as about 100 people move in every day to the Greater Triangle area. Richard Florida, an urban studies theorist who focuses on social and economic theory, noted in a piece last year that geography and connectivity continue to matter, and matter mightily even in our tech-advanced work where we connect with each other seamlessly and instantaneously via Facebook, Twitter, or Skype. He continues by saying that while global airports matter, that does not mean every city has to spend billions to create a state-of-the-art new airport. A city may be just as well served, even better served strategically, on a cost-benefit basis by simply pursuing nonstop connections to the cities with which they intend to share ideas and do business, he says. Budget carriers are doing just that, adding connections. They take out flights and move flights based on their operating grid. If they are able to fill in most of the seats through people flying out of RDU and not flying through RDU, the population surge would pad their profitability. And that by itself will make other carriers take notice. Now we turn to biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Main headline, Apple CEO, be sure to plan for change in your career. When Tim Cook, now the CEO of Apple, was a student in Duke University's MBA program, one of his projects was to write a 25-year plan. Cook, who graduated from the Fuqua School of Business in 1988, found what he wrote 25 years later. This plan had turned yellow because of age, but I looked at it and would say it was reasonably accurate for all of 18 to 24 months, he said in a video posted by Duke. And then it was nothing. There was not a single thing on it that was accurate after that. Not a single thing. Zero. The lesson there, at least for me, is the journey was not predictable at all. The only thing I believe you can do is prepare. The world is going to change many times. The companies you work for are going to ebb and flow. There are lots of things that change, and you sort of have to have a North Star and stay with the North Star and let those things go on about you and find your journey, he says. On May 13, Cook will be the commencement speaker at Duke, and he'll surely address his journey since his days in Durham. Cook is a member of the Duke Board of Trustees, and new Duke president Vince Price thought he'd be an inspirational choice for his commencement. And Bill Boulding, who taught Cook in a marketing class, is now the Fuqua dean. Tim was deeply engaged in class, and even then I was impressed with his analytical thinking and the way he approached problem-solving, Boulding said. I'm not the least bit surprised he's been so successful in leading Apple. I have also personally benefited from Tim's wise counsel through the years. In particular, Tim gave me advice on the importance of focusing on three or four priorities when I became dean. While college students, of course, are dreaming of how they can distinguish themselves, Cook says to remember changes are always coming and to think about how you can contribute to those changes. In his Duke video, he said he values people who really don't care who gets credit, people who can privately celebrate the achievement but not care if their name is the one in the lights. There are greater reasons to do things. Chatham Park charts development timeline. While Amazon might not be coming to Chatham Park, new home lots and commercial development will be in the near future. Developers behind the mega community say they want it to lay the groundwork for 300 lots before beginning pre-sales for any homes. Construction begins this summer on the lots, as well as a slew of other projects at Chatham Park, which will sprawl across more than 7,000 acres. The master planned community will offer 27 styles of home to buy. Preston Development Company owner Tim Smith said May 1. Prices should start around $200,000 for units as small as 800 square feet and then go right on up, Smith said. In terms of the look and layout of the residential development, the best comparison is the nearby Briar Chapel development, built by Newland Communities, Smith said. For Mosaic, a 44-acre slice of the Chatham Park development, site work will likely wait until late summer. The $800 million project includes 700,000 square feet of development, with half dedicated as residential. New event focuses on health. A new festival with some big names, Vivian Howard, Ashley Christensen, and Joe Kwan of the Avett Brothers, is looking to help North Carolinians have a healthier diet. Thrive NC is May 10 through 11 in downtown Raleigh. Tickets are $30 each day. The springboard to why we launched Thrive NC was that there are a lot of startling statistics about food insecurities and childhood obesity in our state, says Reagan Pruitt, Vice President of Integrated Marketing and Community Engagement at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. We rank in the top 10 for most food insecure states in the country, she said. Pruitt said BCBSNC would donate $250,000 to the charitable partners, and all proceeds would go to partners as well. Now you can really take a seat at UNC. Speaking of commencements, Keenan Stadium will have a different look when UNC Chapel Hill holds its graduation ceremonies May 13. UNC is putting in new seats with backs to replace uncomfortable benches. So far, roughly 8,000 of the new seats are in, says Senior Associate Athletic Director Rick Steinbacher. Steinbacher says the fan response has been extremely positive, but UNC won't know full details until after the purchase deadline for the Rams Club. Keenan's seating will drop from 63,000 to 51,000. UNC had $12 million in revenue from ticket sales in 2017 with 7 home games. UNC has 6 home games this year, so revenue will drop, but Steinbacher sees a long-term benefit. Rye Barcott, a 2001 UNC graduate, will give the spring commencement address at Keenan Stadium. From socks to dollars, a Clayton man is turning a common family frustration and inability to keep socks matched into a business with the potential for serious revenue. Kevin Bunn was inspired to create the Sock Doc by his son Kanan, who has Down syndrome. Bunn saw an opportunity to manage the usual sock scramble for his family of four and also help Kanan develop fine motor skills. Bunn struggled with the design until he found an approach that included a simple but effective string prototype. He says he sold approximately 12,000 units from March 1, 2017 to February 28, with $96,725 in gross income, but those numbers are rapidly climbing. Insider did a video on his idea and sales started pouring in. When my website gets a sale, my phone dings like it's an old-timey cash register, Bunn tells Biz. Within 5 minutes, my phone began to ding, to the point it sounded like a woodpecker pecking on wood, just that fast. We were selling over 2,000 per day until we sold out. He was scheduled for an appearance on ABC's Good Morning America recently, which should boost sales even more. Bunn projects revenue of $1.4 million for Sock Doc's second year. He says he has more than 50 new vendor applications and is negotiating an international distribution deal. Everyone wears socks, he says, and everyone hates sorting, matching, and searching for socks. Elon to add on-campus hotel. Having a hotel on or next to campus can be a huge asset for a college. Just think of the Carolina Inn in Chapel Hill, for example, or the Washington Duke Inn and the J.B. Duke Hotel in Durham. So Biz perked up at the announcement that Elon University planned the 80-room Inn at Elon on campus. The Inn will be open to the public, include conference rooms, and will open in 2019. Interesting move by the school. Burlington isn't exactly a tourist mecca and is not overrun with hotels. Elon President Connie Ledoux Book said the new hotel will be a tremendous asset. No costs have been announced yet. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Banking and Technology page, written by Lauren Onersorge. Fiber firm targeting Fuquay. 3 years after announcing its first Triangle service in Holly Springs, Canadian internet provider Ting is expanding its high-speed fiber service in Wake County. The firm confirms the next town it's targeting is Fuquay Varina. Elliot Na, CEO of Ting's parent company, Tucows, says the expansion is a demand-driven decision, and the proximity to its existing infrastructure in Holly Springs made it an easier sell. "We don't have to do nearly as much work on evaluating the opportunity," he says. "We're in the region. We know how great it is for both growth and economic development and recognition of forward-looking technologies." In Fuquay Varina, Ting will hook onto the fiber backbone the town has invested in for much of the past year. As part of a plan to boost internet connectivity to its own facilities, Fuquay Varina has been installing underground conduit. So far, it has invested $750,000 and likely will invest $500,000 more in the build-out, town manager Adam Mitchell says. "It was always our vision that by putting a backbone, a system in place, that it would be attractive enough for a third-party provider to come in and veer off that network," he says. And Mitchell hopes faster internet will help the town attract a new advanced manufacturer to the 35-acre property it recently purchased. The acreage, purchased in January specifically to attract another manufacturing company to the town, is located close enough to that backbone that it could be among the first connections, he says. As for Ting, Fuquay Varina is its second triangle stop, but perhaps not its last. Na says that while current build-out will be focused in the town, he's open to having discussions with other metros in the region. "Any town that is as attractive as Fuquay Varina or Holly Springs that's interested, we'd love to hear from them," he says. Na declines to say if conversations with other metros had already happened. "We're always pretty quiet about that pipeline and discussions take on all forms," he adds. The first Fuquay Varina customers could be connected by the end of the year. First Citizens, KS Bancorp could be in for a lengthy fight. Should the battle over Smithfield-based KS Bancorp go to trial, it won't be anytime soon. That's according to a jointly filed case management report filed in First Citizens' lawsuit against the bank April 26, which lists a proposed trial date of June 10, 2019. That's nearly 2 years after Raleigh-based First Citizens lobbed its second failed buyout proposal for the Johnston County Bank. First Citizens, a KS shareholder, had filed suit February 9 in an effort to squash a KS poison pill provision that prevented First Citizens from increasing its stake in the firm, a move that came after its takeover attempts were rejected last year. The Raleigh Bank won a victory of sorts in March when a North Carolina business court judge ruled the provision was unlawful. But the suit, which also accuses KS's management and directors of breaching their fiduciary duties, continues to play out in back-and-forth briefs. It's unclear how a pending shareholder proposal to convert KS to a Delaware corporation, a move management has told shareholders might mean friendlier interpretations of poison pill provisions, might impact the case. In the meantime, KS is reporting growth, albeit at a slower clip than in years past. In its latest earnings report, KS disclosed a net income of $764,000 for the 3 months ended March 31, a 21% jump from $603,000 for the same time period a year ago. First Citizens also reported its latest earnings. The bank, now at $34.4 billion in assets, reported net income of $100.2 million in its first quarter. Texas company to divest Durham's Appia brand. 3 years after buying Durham-based Appia in a $100 million stock and debt deal, Austin, Texas-based Digital Turbine is selling the unit in a bigger divestiture. The Appia business, now part of Digital Turbine's advertisers and publishers operation, is being sold to Creative Clicks Media, a Netherlands-based company. It's part of an agreement the firms made last month where Creative Clicks is acquiring Digital Turbine's entire advertisers and publishers unit. Digital Turbine CEO Bill Stone says the company will continue to have a strong presence in Durham. CEO moving from Durham to Frontier Campus in RTP. An office building, once home to IBM, will soon house some of the Triangle's loudest entrepreneurship supporters. The Council for Entrepreneurial Development is leaving downtown Durham and heading to Research Triangle Park's Frontier Campus. As the first tenant of the newest Frontier building at 600 Park Offices Drive, it will continue its strategy of helping foster innovation in the state, says Ravila Gupta, president and CEO of CED, and it will have a front row seat to the RTP's planned transformation. "We are excited to be a part of it," Gupta says. Cree CEO bummed by ZTE ban. I mean, it's a bummer. We started off with a ban on selling to one of our bigger customers. I think that's certainly a short-term headwind, but it doesn't change the strategic rationale around what we're doing, and we're really excited about the potential, says Greg Lowe, CEO of Cree, speaking to analysts on April 24, about a week after the U.S. initiated a ban on sales to Chinese firm ZTE. ZTE was a big customer of the Infineon unit Cree purchased earlier this year, and the inability to ship product could mean write-offs. In Cree's recently reported earnings, its Wolfspeed segment, the power and radio frequency device unit that incorporates the Infineon assets, is gaining ground. Lowe told analysts the firm still plans to have Wolfspeed overtake lighting as Cree's largest business. And currently, the revenue breakdown for Q3 2018 is 23% Wolfspeed, 40% LED products, and 37% lighting. And now we turn to On Life Sciences, written by Jennifer Henderson. IQVIA files lawsuit against payroll vendor, and that's spelled IQVIA. Contract research organization IQVIA, which formed from the 2016 merger of Quintiles of Durham and IMS Health of Danbury, Connecticut, has filed a lawsuit in federal court over payroll outsourcing for 13,000 of its employees. IQVIA filed a breach of contract suit recently against Northgate Orinso, or NGA, a payroll processor Quintiles contracted with prior to its merger. IQVIA brings this action on an emergency basis to protect the payroll checks and direct deposits of more than 13,000 IQVIA employees, over 3,000 of whom live and work in and around Durham County, IQVIA states. The immediate injunctive relief IQVIA seeks is crucial to prevent the payroll processor for those 13,000-plus employees from carrying through on its stated threat to now completely cease processing IQVIA employees' paychecks and direct deposits on just 30 days' advance notice to IQVIA. IQVIA alleges that the contract specified payroll outsourcing activities that were slated to be rolled out in six waves by geographic regions of 36,000 Quintiles employees worldwide. But as a result of the merger with IMS, the companies had to integrate a number of systems and functions. While IQVIA decided to continue with the first two waves under the contract with NGA, amounting to upward of 13,000 employees, IQVIA claims it promptly notified NGA that it intended to suspend the implementation of waves 3 through 6 as permitted. But the complaint states IQVIA was invoiced for close to $2.7 million by NGA, which stated that IQVIA had triggered a termination of convenience. IQVIA further states that after requesting NGA's assistance in making necessary connections to its new human resources information system, NGA refused. Through the dispute resolution process, IQVIA has repeatedly asked NGA for written assurances that NGA will not suspend, terminate, or otherwise make any material change to the payroll processing service currently being provided. But NGA has consistently refused to give any such assurances and has instead warned IQVIA that NGA would only provide IQVIA 30 days advance notice of such a termination, IQVIA's complaint states. The complaint says such a move would be irreparably harming to IQVIA's employees and its reputation. An IQVIA spokesman declined to comment, and NGA did not return a request for comment. Aerie puts first drug on market, another coming. Aerie Pharmaceuticals, which recently tapped Durham as its home base, has launched its first drug and has another one on the horizon. After hiring and training a 100-person sales force, Aerie's glaucoma drug, Ropressa, is in national and regional pharmaceutical distributors in the U.S. Aerie President and Chief Operating Officer Tom Mitro says the company received upward of 5,300 applications and resumes for about 120 sales positions, including sales managers, across the U.S. Aerie started in 2005 when Dr. David Epstein, a glaucoma specialist at Duke University, was looking for new medication to treat his patients. The launch of the company's first approved product is a fantastic milestone for Aerie that started years ago with just an idea, Mitro says. Airy turned that idea into a molecule and moved it through development, including manufacturing and necessary financing, he adds, ultimately getting to a point where now 95 out of 100 companies are not able to reach. Getting to a point now where 95 out of 100 companies are not able to reach. Airy could see between $20 million and $30 million in net revenue from Ropressa this year, with sales potentially soaring past $100 million next year. The company is awaiting approval for a second glaucoma drug, Rocklatin. With the infrastructure in place from Ropressa, the company should be able to add Rocklatin right into the bag and launch it very quickly after getting approval, Mitro says. Airy is also looking beyond glaucoma. We are growing from a company just focused on glaucoma into a company focused on glaucoma and the retina area, Mitro says. Biogen to add 150 jobs in RTP. Biotechnology giant Biogen plans to hire 150 people in Research Triangle Park over the next 2 years for a new global business services center. According to the company, the GBS Center will support services across the company's many geographies and business units, ultimately making it easier for its employees to connect with each other and access the services they need. Biogen said it selected RTP for the GBS Center, given the company's 23-year history in the park, as well as the access to talent the area provides. Since 2016, Cambridge, Massachusetts-based Biogen has invested upward of $125 million in its RTP facilities. Datavant makes major moves. Datavant, a growing healthcare technology company backed by Roivant, has made a big acquisition and banked upward of $40 million. Datavant has acquired Massachusetts-based Universal Patient Key, or UPK, and banked $40.5 million in a financing round led by Roivant, as well as co-founder and CEO of Datavant, Travis May. Companies and nonprofit organizations in the healthcare space are increasingly keen to derive actionable insights from available data. But a significant obstacle is the fact that disparate data sets are held by different institutions, May said in an email. We want to make it easier for institutions to share data in a HIPAA-compliant manner, and this acquisition will make it easier for us to achieve that aim. UPK's current client base includes Allscripts, McKesson, and IBM Watson. Earlier this year, Datavant said that it had landed its first academic partner in Duke Clinical Research Institute. Datavant is among a list of drug development companies wholly or majority owned by Roivant, including Axovant, Neurology, and Myovant, Women's Health and Endocrine Diseases. Training Center changed to accommodate new needs. Grifols and Novo Nordisk are expanding in the Triangle, and so is the training center that produces talent for the biomanufacturing giants. The $1.3 million renovation of the Johnston County Workforce Center is underway and expected to finish in September. Chris Johnson, director of the Johnston County Office of Economic Development, says the space illustrates how times are changing. When the facility was first built, it was constructed as a traditional education system with a middle hallway and classrooms to the left and right. With the renovation, it's really going to be simulated workspace. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Ben Graham. Raleigh unveils new station. Congressman David Price stood before a few hundred people gathered in the belly of Raleigh's new Union Station on the morning of April 30 and congratulated all of those involved in bringing the project to fruition. As for himself, the Democrat representing the 4th District said he was proud of the role he played in shaking money loose to help pay for the project. All told, the station and associated track and road work amounted to just over $110 million. Of that, the federal government paid $70.4 million, according to numbers provided by the city. The federal contributions came in the form of grants from the Department of Transportation. As work wraps up on the final touches of the first phase of Union Station, city officials say they have only just begun to dig into questions about funding for future phases, and it might be that they need Price to do a bit more shaking. The federal government is still interested in being partners, Mayor Nancy McFarland said. Union Station was designed to be a multimodal hub that could act as an entry point into the city where people could hop off the train and onto a bus or commuter rail car to get to their final destination. But as it stands now, the station only adds capacity for more Amtrak train service. Future phases are key, and next in line is new bus infrastructure, although the project is still years away. Go Triangle owns buildings along Southwest Street, just around the corner from the station. Early plans involve redeveloping the property to allow for bus bays on the ground floor and mixed-use space above. Go Triangle General Manager Jeff Mann said, "The agency is currently undergoing a market assessment to identify the best uses for the building," Mann said. New condos near Cameron Village among firms' plans. A luxury residential developer that has been making inroads in the Triangle in recent years has plans to build 51 condos a block away from Cameron Village. On a parcel directly to the west, Lambert Development has already begun construction on 11 high-end townhomes with price tags starting around $900,000. Each is outfitted with an elevator and garage parking. On the other side of the Triangle in downtown Durham, the firm is under contract to buy a 0.6-acre lot currently home to Vega Metals down the street from Liberty Warehouse Apartments. If all goes according to plan, the company will build 54 condos on the site, currently home to a garage built in 1925, according to county records. For the New York-based real estate company, the flurry of high-end condo projects has become business as usual in the Triangle, and all that development appears to be in high demand. On West Street in Raleigh, the firm has finished and sold the first 12 condos of the West and Lenore project and is about to begin construction on another 9. Prices start just above $500,000. The firm's first Triangle foray was a 7-story project called the Brannan at Central Park in Durham. All 35 condos sold months before it opened last year. Founder and principal Henry Lambert says all of the region's metrics remain favorable, from the population growth to the temperate climate. "It's a persuasive part of the world," Lambert says. Elsewhere in Raleigh, the company has plans to build smaller, at least in terms of units. The property at 611 West South Street still has a large hole in the ground where Lambert has abandoned its plans to build 40 townhome-style condos. Instead, the firm now plans 88 units, a change that matches the demand for smaller units. Video game developer expanding into new 53,000-square-foot space in Cary. A video game developer in Cary is consolidating its operations in the Triangle and moving into a larger 3-building office campus it purchased on Weston Parkway. Red Storm Entertainment has finalized the acquisition of a 5-acre parcel with 52,711 square feet of office space, paying $5.6 million for the Weston office campus. Parent company Ubisoft says it will be housing 2 arms of the company under one roof. Its NCSA Customer Relationship Center will join Red Storm Entertainment in the space after renovations. Ubisoft's 2 local North Carolina teams, Red Storm Entertainment and the NCSA Customer Relationship Center, will both be working in the Cary campus after renovations of the property and look forward to additional business growth over time. Red Storm Vice President of Product Development Elizabeth Loverso said. A company spokesman said the expanded space won't necessarily result in more jobs, but noted the company is looking to expand. Another pricey apartment sale in Durham. A San Diego company has acquired an apartment complex in Durham, paying $35.3 million for the Falls Point at the Park community. Just a year ago, 6 of the units at the complex were damaged in a fire in April. Fairfield Residential of San Diego bought the community from Ohio-based NRP Group, the original developer. The complex sits on 46 acres at the intersection of T.W. Alexander Drive and South Alston Avenue. The development consists of 16 three-story buildings. Fairfield works in states on the east and west coasts. The sale adds to what has been a strong year for multifamily sales in the Triangle. In the first quarter of 2018, 14 apartment complexes priced at more than $10 million sold for a total of $566 million. The first quarter of 2017 saw just 9 sales in the same range, totaling $393 million. Perimeter 5 gets new equity partner. A real estate investment company with a global reach has swooped in to help carry the construction of a new Perimeter Park office building across the finish line. Capri EMG, based in Chicago, has signed on to provide the developer with financing for the completion of the Perimeter 5 office building, which will serve as the future headquarters of global contract research organization Syneos Health. Capri CEO Shelby Pruitt says his firm is injecting capital into the project at a little over the halfway point of construction. He declined to provide the terms of the deal, but says the firm has also committed to buying the property once the building is complete. By way of comparison, nearby Lenovo office buildings on Development Drive sold for $280 per square foot in February, although the buildings are two decades old. At a similar rate, the Syneos building would fetch nearly $72 million. Panel of builders, developers not enthused by Amazon. Despite enthusiasm throughout the Triangle about making Amazon's shortlist for its second headquarters, some developers and builders say they don't think it would be great for the Triangle. Amazon's presence here would drive up development and housing prices, Preston Development CEO Tim Smith said, and that doesn't necessarily mean more revenue for developers. Everything else goes up proportionally, he said at Triangle Business Journal's Power Breakfast May 1 at PNC Arena. For its long-term office space needs, the expansion would require the equivalent of 16 Wells Fargo Capital Centers, the 30-story tower in downtown Raleigh, in addition to housing for 50,000 employees and their families. Proponents of Amazon moving to the Triangle have argued that the growth would take place slowly over more than a decade, but Smith isn't convinced. Land prices are already rising across the Triangle, pushing the cost of development higher and making affordability a problem for residents and builders, Smith said. Two custom home builders who spoke alongside Smith agreed on the downside of the Amazon sweepstakes. I just don't have a good feeling about it, said Rex Bost, owner of Bost Custom Homes. I think it will change the dynamic of our way of living here, and I think we have enough growth of industry that we don't really need an Amazon. John Rufty, owner of Rufty Homes, said he supports quality growth, but he doesn't think that's what Amazon would provide. I think Amazon would bring too much too fast, Rufty said. Renters wouldn't be immune either. A study from Apartment List found that Raleigh renters would see the biggest hikes of any of the 20 metros Amazon is considering for its second headquarters. Rents would rise between 1.5% and 2% in the Triangle, resulting in additional costs of $11,756 to $15,356 over a decade. Preston Smith also commented, tongue partially in cheek, on the likely political leanings of the droves of new people the company would bring. If you bring in 50,000 employees and multiply that by three people in a family, you've got 150,000 more liberal young people here, Smith said, eliciting raucous laughter from the crowd. Preston Development is developing Chatham Park, which was on the list of seven places included as potential headquarters sites in the region's pitch. But April 30, Preston Development co-owner Bubba Rawl said the firm had been told it was no longer in consideration. Candidly, we were thinking we were a little bit of a long shot to land a group like that, Rawl said. It's going to be hard. They want a mass transit program, and there's just not one around here. Amazon scouts visited the Triangle in late March. Executives and government officials have been tight-lipped about the site Amazon visited, but Rawl said the company is only considering two locations within the Triangle at this point. One is downtown Raleigh, where developer John Kane of Kane Realty Corporation has pitched the idea of a prime corridor that would stretch from Dorothea Dix Park to North Hills. Such a proposal would have to involve multiple developers and property owners, Kane has said. Rawl said he wasn't sure of the other site under consideration. Research Triangle Park, specifically the former GlaxoSmithKline campus now owned by Palmer Innovation Centers, is talked about as one of the few places that could provide the space and infrastructure Amazon would need. And with our remaining minutes with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll read as much as we can of the column from the Viewpoint page. Headlined, "We Can't Take Facebook at Face Value." This is written by Drew Hansen, who is the digital producer at the Washington Business Journal. Mark Zuckerberg doesn't have your privacy in mind. He never will. Those thinking otherwise are as clueless as those aging senators on Capitol Hill who were recently asking Facebook's founder and CEO how his business works. You'd think they could have at least showed up prepared. Zuckerberg has himself and his company in mind and very little else. That shouldn't be surprising. That's business, after all. He paid lip service to lawmakers, made his apologies, and will go back to work, getting his company's share price back to where it was in early March. That's what CEOs do. But what the Cambridge Analytica scandal, where the political data firm inappropriately mined the personal data of 87 million Facebook users, and Zuckerberg's apology tour have created is an important dialogue about whether we need to regulate the social network. Every couple of decades, an American company becomes so dominant or saturated that the government steps in. We're at a flashpoint with Facebook, not to mention Airbnb, Uber, and a handful of other tech-centric companies, and it appears too late for self-regulation for many of them, especially for Zuckerberg's baby, which is now floating between so many industries I'm not sure a government entity exists to keep an eye on it. On a much simpler level, the situation with Facebook has given us permission to jump ship, and that's something to consider. If a company is using our personal data in a very questionable way, let's not wait for a snail-paced government to figure out a system of supervision or moderation. Instead, let us, the consumers, turn it off or change the way we use it. The Federal Trade Commission will likely hit Facebook with a massive fine for violating privacy promises, but it will be a fine the company, boasting a $480 billion market cap, can afford to pay. Listen, Facebook has been pretty great in some regards. It was a fun ride in the beginning. We connected with old friends who moved out of our lives a long, long time ago. We started conversations with family members we hadn't seen in decades. And we got to see photos of our college friends' kids and pets and what's coming off their barbecue grills. But to find that good information, the stuff we want to see, we have to shovel through a giant, time-wasting pile of twaddle. And some of it's downright abhorrent. I'd even argue it gets uglier and messier than Twitter. For every adorable video of a child's first steps, you have to flip past a profanity-laden political discussion involving a former coworker, a borderline racist meme from a distant relative, someone throwing their own online pity party, and a couple of ads for over-the-counter indigestion medicine, underwear, and an iffy-looking e-commerce site. And that's on a good day. Sure, you can curate your feed, but is that a garden we really have time or desire to tend? And we'll stop there, as the article advises you to make your profile private, to turn off geotagging, and to hide your friends list and limit who can see old posts. And we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please feel free to give us a call, 919-832-5138.